Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us this month on Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum. Please forgive my very wide impression. I'm just getting over a cold, but I wanted to make sure that we still had today's event. Again, as a reminder for those of you who are attending today's event, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call will be on April 2nd, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. Often what we do here is we ask you to go ahead and submit your questions in the questions box, which I see that a few of you have already done so. So thank you very much for submitting your questions. We will make sure to try to get to those by the end of the call. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun. I usually try to do it in somewhere between half an hour to 45 minutes into the call so that way you can start preparing for your Q&A session. I will unmute you if you choose to come on the line and speak to us directly. I will unmute you so that you can have the floor and ask your question live. Again, another option is for you to go ahead and just type in your question in the questions box. So now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin with this month's Practitioners Forum call. Joining us today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a successful history of executing and helping to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays on the first Tuesday of each month. Like this morning, the practitioner's call is offered. As you know, it's a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar, learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. And if you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. With that said, I want to go ahead and start taking on our first questions here. Another reminder is our VIP membership program allows you several perks, and one of those perks is being able to guarantee to have your questions answered while you are a VIP member. So the first few questions here are coming directly from VIP members. The first one is Carlton Perkins. Mr. Perkins is a longtime member and attendee of several of our seminars and other events. So thank you very much for joining us again, Mr. Perkins. First one is, a husband and wife filed a joint return. There was an audit. After the audit, the tax liability increased. The couple divorced, and the ex-wife requested innocent spouse relief. Innocent spouse relief was denied. Can the ex-spouses enter an agreement with the IRS where they can split the tax liability?
The answer is no. The spouses or ex-spouses can enter into agreement between themselves. For instance, the divorce decree or divorce settlement agreement or something could specify, for instance, that the husband will pay the tax liability, but any agreement between the ex-spouses is only between them and is not subject to the IRS. The IRS can go after either ex-spouse because they filed a joint return and they're jointly and severally liable for the tax liability. So all they could do is either enter into separate installment agreements, or one of them could agree to pay it. And if they default on that agreement, then they would have a breach of contract action against the other ex-spouse. I'm not sure why the innocent spouse relief was denied, if there's and when, because there's an opportunity to appeal that, and they could be successful in the appeal, but I don't know if those appeal rights have been extinguished or not. But to answer your question, there is no agreement between the IRS and the ex-spouses on who will pay. They'll go after either or both until the liability is paid in full.
All right, Mr. Perkins, hopefully that helps you there. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to the next member, this is Jesse, who's an EA, and Jesse's asking, when a lien is placed on real estate, do subsequent interest and penalties get added to that lien?
The answer is yes. And the way to look at a federal tax lien is it's a notice. It's a notice recorded in the county recorder's office so that anybody looking at that property will see whether or not there are certain encumbrances on the property, including federal or state tax liens. But the amount on the notice of federal tax lien could be more or less than what's actually owed, because the tax could have been paid down, or they could have made no payments and penalties and interest continue to accrue, so they owe more than is on the notice. So the purpose of the federal tax lien is just a notice so that, for instance, if they're selling the house and they're going through escrow, then the escrow officer will send a demand letter to the IRS saying that, asking the IRS to specify how much they owe the IRS and what's required to get the lien removed. And that amount may be more or less than what the number that's on the actual notice of federal tax lien that got recorded. So to answer your question, that number is fluid. It could be more or less depending on whether they paid it down or whether or not penalties and interest have made it go up.
Okay, Jesse, hopefully that takes care of that for you. Moving on to Michael, also a VIP member. Michael's asking, is there a maximum penalty amount that can be abated under the first-time penalty abatement program? Can the FTPA program be applied both to individuals and businesses? And how difficult is it to obtain an FTPA?
Okay, so I'll answer each one of those questions. No, there's no maximum penalty amount, but there are certain kinds of penalties that the first-time penalty abatement program applies to and some that it doesn't. The most common penalties that it applies to is failure to pay and failure to file. So those are really the big penalties that the program was designed to deal with. And it can be applied to both individuals and businesses. And it's not difficult, but it's not always very satisfying either. And that's because if you call the IRS, let's say you call ACS, and you ask, does this taxpayer qualify for the first-time penalty abatement program? They're going to go through a series of questions on their computer and put in the input, and the computer is going to tell them right there whether or not they qualify or not. So you can get an answer while you're on the phone. The unsatisfying part of it is that the computer program's not very good, and it oftentimes just says no, even if they do. So if the first-time penalty abatement program is denied, you're going to get a letter, and you're going to get an appeal right, and you might want to appeal it because the computer program isn't very accurate. But you may get lucky, and oftentimes they'll tell you right then that, yeah, they qualify, and you'll get a letter in a little while saying that the penalty has been abated. So it's not a difficult process. It's just not very accurate, but it's definitely worth trying. But the thing is, what I always tell taxpayers is the first time penalty abatement program is a one-time thing. That's why it's first time. And so you might want to be careful on how you use it. I think I would first try to get the penalty abated by reasonable cause. And if you fail on the reasonable cause standard, then I would apply for the first-time penalty abatement. But I wouldn't want to use first-time penalty abatement if I could get out of the penalty using reasonable cause, and then you would still have the first-time penalty abatement to use later. So I would think that the first-time penalty abatement would not be your first choice. I think the reasonable cause standard would be your first choice.
All right, Norman. There you go, Michael. Thank you very much. Moving on to the next VIP member. This is Leslie. I am new to tax resolution and have only had experience with setting of installment agreements online. How do you decide what the best method to resolve a client's tax problem is? What is your process? Any guidance will be helpful.
So the first thing we do is have the client prepare, or we prepare a 433F for the client so we can get a picture of their financial collection information. So after looking at a 433F, there's several choices you can make. The first question is, do they qualify for currently not collectible? And that would be based on that the taxpayer has less than $25 a month disposable income. If they do, then they may qualify for currently non-collectible. The other thing you want to look at is what years do they owe for, and how old are the years? Are we approaching the collection statute so that the tax is going to be uncollectible soon, or do the taxpayers have years to go before the tax becomes uncollectible? If they're not, if they don't qualify for currently not collectible status, then the next would be an installment agreement. And there's basically two kinds of installment agreement, a full pay and a partial pay. So first, if I would look for a low monthly payment, partial pay installment agreement, and that would be anywhere starting at $25 a month. And that would be kind of nice because they're making $25 a month payments. The IRS is leaving them alone, and the collection statute continues to run. And at some point, the tax is going to be uncollectible. The balance will be forgiven, and they can stop making those $25 a month payments. So that would be a partial pay installment agreement. And that would be my next choice. After that, it would be a full pay installment agreement, and that would be that the taxpayer has the ability to pay the full tax, and you can do that under a streamline agreement. If they owe under $50,000, you would simply take the balance and divide by 72, and that would be that the taxpayer would make an installment agreement for 72 months, at the end of which the tax would be paid off in full. If they owe between $50,000 and $100,000, there's a program called Extended Streamline Installment Agreement, and that would be for 84 months. So you take the amount owed between $50,000 and $100,000, divide by 84. That would be their monthly payment. And after 84 months, the tax would be paid in full. The other option would be an offer in compromise. And that would be if the taxpayers don't have a lot of equity in their home or don't have a lot of value in their assets, because an offer and compromise is basically the liquidation value of their assets plus their disposable income over the life of the statute. So an offer may be appropriate. The best example of an offer would be, so somebody made a lot of money at some time, owed a lot of taxes and didn't pay it, and now they're retired and they're living on Social Security, and they rent, or they don't own a home and they don't have any assets, and basically they need all their Social Security money just to live on, and there's nothing left over for the IRS. That's the perfect candidate for an offer. I oftentimes tell clients that they're too young and good looking for an offer. And what that means is that if the IRS determines that they have the potential in the future to pay the tax, they won't accept an offer. So if a taxpayer is between jobs or currently unemployed, doesn't make them a candidate for an offer, because that's just a temporary situation and the IRS is looking at their long-term potential for earnings, not just looking at their current picture of what job they have now, but what their potential is in the future. And so not everybody's a candidate for an offer, but basically those are your four or five choices, anywhere from currently non-collectible to an offer and compromise with installment agreements in between.
Thank you, Norman, for that thorough explanation. And that actually answered some of the questions that some of you have already submitted online. So I'm thankful for that. For those who have further questions, we'll circle back on these individual solutions if time permits. Okay, moving on to Robert, another VIP member. I am preparing my first offer and compromise and want to make sure I cover all my bases. My question for the call is, how do you calculate the amount of the deductible term life insurance premium on an offer and compromise? Also, any other pointers I should know before submitting the offer?
So term life insurance has no cash value, so that's good. And on the 433A OIC, which is the collection information statement you complete for an offer, everything is done monthly. So if they're paying their premiums annually or semi-annually or whatever, you want to figure it out what their monthly premium is. And that's what you would list as an expense. And then you would hopefully have proof by either their premiums, invoices or statements, and cancel checks or bank statements or whatever. But you want to, regardless of how the premium is paid, you want to reduce it to a monthly amount. And if you complete the 433A OIC and you go through the calculations at the end, it will tell you what the taxpayer should offer, the amount of the offer that they should submit. And also the IRS has an offer calculator online, and you go through the offer calculator. It asks you some questions. Is the taxpayer in bankruptcy, for instance? Because if they are, they can't submit an offer. If they filed all their returns, they have to. They can't have any delinquent outstanding returns. And then you do the calculation, and it's simple. It tells you what the offer you should submit. That doesn't necessarily mean that they would accept that offer. It just means that that's the minimum that they would accept. Unlike, let's say, for instance, with the California Franchise Tax Board, which has no calculator and doesn't have a number, they say that they look at each offer independently, but they do kind of have a rule of thumb, and that is disposable income times, let's say, 60 months or something. And so it's a really a different approach, and oftentimes you end up paying the franchise tax board more than you pay the IRS, even though the taxpayer owes the IRS less. So the IRS offer program is really much better than any state program that I know of.
All right, Robert, hopefully answers your question. And also the premium amount is fully allowable, so there's no limitation on the amount that the IRS allows for the IRS.
And it's not an asset. There's no face value on a term life insurance.
So there's works in both in favors more than one time there. Okay, moving on to Monica, also a VIP member. She's asking, California Franchise Tax Board has levied my client's bank accounts here in Texas. My client used to live in California 15 years ago, but hasn't filed several returns while living there. We contacted the FTB, and they want her to file the returns. What can I do to make sure the client isn't responsible for California taxes? She holds a California state broker's license in case she ever sells property there.
Okay, so the problem is that she didn't file these returns, and I guess the Franchise Tax Board prepared what's called Notice of Proposed Assessment, which is similar to an IRS SFR. And after 60 days, that NPA, or Notice of Proposed Assessment, became final. I don't know how long that is, because California has 20 years to collect from assessment, as opposed to IRS, which only has 10 years. The thing is, if you go ahead and file those California returns, then that's going to result in a new assessment, and that new assessment will have another 20 years to collect on. So you may be better off just allowing the NPA to be final, and that statute might expire before filing a new return. But the thing is, I would go ahead and file or prepare like a draft return to determine if they would owe less on the filed return than they would on the NPA. But the thing is that California is going to continue collection, and they have sister state rights with other states. So wherever the taxpayer is, like for instance in Texas, even though Texas doesn't have a state income tax, they do have a sister state relationship with California, and California can levy the taxpayer in Texas. So I would prepare those returns, but I would only file them if she's going to owe significantly less based on the returns than she did on the NPAs. And remember now, we got all that interest and penalties and stuff. So it's going to be a lot more than just the tax on the return. But if she lived in California in those years, then she did need to file a resident return. And even if she didn't live in California, she would need to file a non-resident return if she made any money in California. If she, for instance, sold property in California and got a commission, even though she didn't live in California at the time. So your first step is prepare the returns, compare them to the NPAs, and make a decision on whether or not you want to file those returns or not.
Right, and also having that broker license, sometimes the California state does an assessment based on averages, people with license, professional
right,
license.
Right, if you don't file a return, then the notice of proposed assessment creates an income from you based on what the average California broker, for instance, for her makes made that year, and that's what they would assess against her. Or if you own a property, then they base it on your mortgage payment. They assume that your mortgage payment is one quarter of your monthly income. And so they figure what your income is based on what your mortgage payment is if you own property in California. So there's ways that they come up with it. So yeah, also, depending on how much they owe, they could suspend her license too.
Would you recommend her filing non-resident returns every year?
Only if she's making money in California. It just says that she has a California state broker's license. It doesn't say that she's making any money on it.
All right, Monica, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to our last VIP member call here or question here. It's Elton as asking, what is a typical timeline for getting a lien removed? I've never done a lien release and would like to know the general procedure.
Well, I need to know the grounds that you're seeking the lien released. Is it because the tax has been paid, or is it because the statute has expired, or, you know, what are the grounds for releasing the lien? But and it doesn't say if it's state or federal, but if it's an IRS federal tax lien and the tax has either been paid or the statute has expired for collection, then they're supposed to do it within 30 days.
And aren't these liens self-releasing, Norman?
So on the face of a federal tax lien, it says that the notice of federal tax lien acts as a release 30 days after the time to renew the lien is expired, which is 10 years from the date of assessment. So if the statute is expired, then the lien is supposed to self-release after that 10-year period. And that's on the face of the lien. And what the IRS says is they don't need to do anything because the document itself shows that the lien automatically releases itself after the statute expires, unless the IRS renews the lien they have a certain window, like I think it's a year before to 30 days after the date of assessment.
All right. Thank you, Norman. We are at our halfway point, so I want to make sure that I open it up to those of you who are on the line. Go ahead and submit your questions online now. That way, when we get a little bit closer towards the end, I'll be able to get some of these questions answered. I'm going to take a quick minute here just to explain our ultimate membership package or VIP membership package. As you know, one of the perks is to get your questions answered during this practitioner's forum every first Tuesday of the month. But let me give you some of the other perks. So aside from these calls, a lot of VIP members take advantage of our consultation time. And what that means is that you get one-on-one interaction with Norman or any other of our professionals to answer your specific questions. And it doesn't have to be resolution a matter only, also tax questions as well. A lot of you do submit tax questions, tax-related questions, preparation questions on this forum, and we do our best to get them answered before, or sometimes we bring on a CPA of ours on here directly to answer these questions. So a few of you did submit those type of questions, and I don't have answers for you now. So what we will do is I will refer those to the CPAs and email you back a response. But anyways, moving on to the VIP membership package, other perks that you get is you get free access to videos on demand, free comprehensive library, which includes a lot of valuable white papers that goes into detail on specific offers, installment agreements, streamlined installment agreements, the changes. Some of you asked about the 84-month when the liability is under 100 grand but over 50. So we have some of those white papers available. You get e-learning courses. So a lot of our courses that teach you how to do installment agreements, how to prepare an offer and compromise, and how to be successful in any of these become available to you at no additional cost. That's a value of about $79 to $99 per course. So take advantage of that. Look at our website for all the courses that are available. You also get free webinars. So when we do have the live webinars, you get access to those as well. Again, those go for $99 to $149, depending on the event itself. 20% off all other items on our website, including our manuals, our textbooks, and any other physical materials that you might need to be able to help grow your practice. The goal here, as Norman mentioned in the beginning, and Peter also mentioned this, is we want to make sure you grow your practice. Make sure you expand beyond tax preparation to also include resolution. So we want you to be successful, and we're giving you the tools to be able to do that. And this VIP membership is a must if you want to be able to get that done, because you get the added support, the information to help guide you. So as we do on a regular basis here, we offer a free 2-month trial for those of you who are on the phone. So I'm going to go ahead and push a link, giving you access to join as a VIP member and try us out for 2 months for free. So I'll be sending that here shortly. But enough of the selling, enough of the membership package here. Let's move on to the rest of these questions so we can get to those of you who submitted online as well. So next question, Norman, is from Brandon. Brandon is asking about CSED dates. So we all know that the statute for collection is 10 years for the IRS, but when that clock starts seem to be an ever-moving target. What are the common events that prevent the statute from continuing to run?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with the IRS CSED is it's not an ever-moving target. It's really, really simple. It's 10 years from the date of assessment. So the thing is, any given tax year could have several dates of assessment and several CSEDs. For instance, taxpayer files a return, the return gets processed, and the taxpayer owes money based on the filed return. And if you look at the account transcript, it shows that the return was received, and then it shows the date that the return was processed, and that's the date that the tax was actually assessed. So even though, for instance, the IRS received the taxpayer's Form 1040 on April 15th, it wasn't assessed because it wasn't processed until May or June. Then let's say that the IRS audits that return and, you know, disallow some Schedule C expenses or get some 1099s that weren't on the return, and they adjust the income expenses, and they determine that the taxpayer owes additional liability. Well, that's a second assessment, and that assessment will have its own assessment date and its own CSED. And so it's not just one CSED, and it's not moving. It's the date of assessment. Now, that CSED could be tolled based on several tolling events, like filing appeals, filing an offer and compromise, filing a bankruptcy. So there's certain events that toll the 10 years, but the date of the assessment is a very simple one-time date. And some other events that toll the statute is if the taxpayer's out of the country for more than 6 months, if they file a collection due process appeal, an offer, also the time that an installment agreement request is pending. It's not the time that the installment agreement is running while the taxpayer is making monthly payments, but the time between when the taxpayer requests an installment agreement to either when that installment agreement is accepted or when the installment agreement is rejected plus 30 days, because they have 30 days to appeal the rejection of the installment agreement. If they appeal it, then that appeal continues the tolling. So those are the things you need to look at, and usually they would appear on the account transcript, but not always. Also, if you're talking to ACS, you can ask them when the CSET is, and they'll tell you. Or sometimes, you may have software that determines the CSET for you based on the account transcripts. So those are the kinds of things that toll the statute. But absent that, the tax would become uncollectible 10 years from the date of assessment.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Moving on to Gilbert. Gilbert is asking, I have a case that has been with an RO for over 18 months. We formally requested an installment agreement and the RO has not made a formal decision. I don't want to contact the RO since there hasn't been any collection activity for my client. My question is, will the pending installment agreement toll the CSET date the entire time? Liabilities from 2009 and was hoping to run out that clock.
Yeah, so that's the rub. You don't want to wake up the revenue officer, but the statute is tolled while a request for an installment agreement is being reviewed. So the thing is that what you want? Do you really, you can't have it both ways. Either it's not collectible because there's a pending request for an installment agreement, or the statute is running and it will soon expire and they won't owe, but you can't have both. So it shouldn't take a revenue officer 18 months. So you may want to find out what's going on, unless you don't mind that the collection statute is, clock is stopped. And, so for the last 18 months, the clock hasn't moved, and they're going to tack that on to the end. So you really have to ask yourself which is more important. But definitely it's not usual for revenue officers to take 18 months. They usually want the file off their desk. So you might want to contact them and find out what's going on. Before doing that, though, you maybe get an account transcript and see what the account transcript says. For all you know, that the revenue officer may have somehow denied the request for an installment agreement and somehow you missed that and the statute's running again. So I would first order an account transcript, see what it says. If it shows that the installment agreement request is still pending with no resolution, I would contact a revenue officer, because you're really not doing your taxpayer client any favor by tolling the collection statute for that long a time.
Plus the interest continues to accumulate,
right,
too.
Right, exactly.
Okay, moving on to the next question. This is from Bernice. Bernice has a question related to amended return and the IRS denying it. Bernice, as I mentioned to you here online, I'm going to defer this to one of our CPAs and get back to you directly on that so that we can address your question there. Moving on to Alex. Alex is an EA, and he says, a client owes $270,000, including interest and penalties. I've heard you mention before that if the liability exceeds $250,000, we can request to have the case assigned to a revenue officer. We just received a notice of intent to levy. Is it too late to request the RO? What advantages, disadvantages can I expect in dealing with an RO?
So, first of all, no, it's not too late to request the RO. I would call the number on the notice of intent to levy, which should be ACS, and ask them that the case be assigned to a local revenue officer, and usually the local revenue officer is local to the taxpayer. You could sometimes request that the local revenue officer be local to the power of attorney, but usually power of attorney and taxpayer are in the same area, and so the local revenue officer would be local to both. And you, what you do is you ask that the taxpayer be put in queue for the case to be assigned to the field, and that will go to a local revenue officer. Now your next question is, and also once you do that, the case gets taken out of ACS, so there's no worry of levy. It's out of ACS's hands, and so there will be no levy. You'll be contacted by a local revenue officer, and depending on where you live, that could be anywhere from 60 days to 6 months. So, because they have 30 days from your request to assign it to the local IRS office, and then that local manager has 30 days to assign it to a local revenue officer within that office, and then that revenue officer would contact the power of attorney. The advantages and disadvantages is that with ACS, you complete a Form 433F, which is just two pages, where with a revenue officer, they want a Form 433A, which is 6 to 8 pages, depending on whether or not the taxpayer is self-employed or not. So it goes into much further detail. And the revenue officer will ask for more documents, like bank statements and things like that, more documents than ACS would ask for, because usually ACS you can handle it with one phone call, where with the revenue officer, there's quite a bit of back and forth. The revenue officer may want to visit the taxpayer's home or the taxpayer's business, and they're going to look at it under much more scrutiny. The advantage is that there's one person handling the case, and if you have a question or if there's a problem, you can just pick up the phone and call the revenue officer with their direct phone number and deal with that particular revenue officer who's familiar with the case and deal with it, where if you call ACS, it's pick of the draw. You could get somebody anywhere in the country, and all they're going to know about the case is what shows up when they plug it into the computer. And depending on how detailed notes the prior ACS agent left on the computer, they may or may not know everything. So it's really kind of luck of the draw. So we prefer dealing with revenue officers, especially if you do this for a while, then you get to know the revenue officers in your area. And if you deal with them in a honest manner and they learn to trust you, then dealing with the local revenue officer can really be a simple thing and be really nice, because you know them and they know you, and you can really get results in a good way. So, yeah, I would call right away and ask that the case be put in queue for assignment to the field.
All right, Alex, there you go. Moving on to Krista. Krista's a CPA. She's asking, thanks for taking my question. I've been attending these events every chance I get, and I've picked up a lot of good pointers. Hoping you could help me with a longtime client that I have. This is a notorious procrastinator. He's late in getting me information to prepare the returns. does not make estimated tax payments, and continues to add to his tax bill. I want to be able to create a permanent solution for some of the older years he owes and believe they now qualify to be discharged in bankruptcy, approximately $60,000. Is BK similar to an offer where he has to be in compliance after BK for a certain amount of time? What tolling events should I look out for?
Okay, so here's what I tell all CPAs, EAs, and others regarding the practice of bankruptcy. Don't do it. You're not admitted to practice bankruptcy law, and you shouldn't be. The extent of your advice should be those taxes may be dischargeable in bankruptcy. I suggest that you contact a bankruptcy attorney familiar with discharging taxes and ask them. I mean, there's really nothing in it for a CPA to offer their clients bankruptcy advice and a lot of pitfalls, and you're kind of looking at potential malpractice suit, which nobody needs. So, but to answer your question, before the taxpayer files bankruptcy, they have to be in compliance before they file, and they have to remain in compliance during the while the bankruptcy is pending. So in that sense, the answer is yes. And the tolling events are similar to the tolling events on this on the collection statute, and that's pending installment agreements, submitted offers, appeals like collection due process, being out of the country. But again, that's what we do is I do a tax dischargeability analysis. I've been doing this 25 years, and it can be tricky. And really, it's like an opinion letter where if you tell a client, yeah, it's okay to file bankruptcy, and you miss something, you're in big trouble. And so I don't offer my advice freely. You know, if a taxpayer wants to hire somebody to do a tax dischargeability analysis, it better be a bankruptcy attorney, and not just any bankruptcy attorney, but a bankruptcy attorney that specializes in discharging taxes, because it's a very specialized field. And so as a CPA, the best advice you can give your client is you may qualify for bankruptcy to discharge the taxes. I suggest that you consult a bankruptcy attorney with experience on discharging taxes, and you've done your job. And that's really all you need to do.
Thank you, Norman, for that. Krista, hopefully that helps you there. We're going to go ahead and start taking some of these calls from online. So the first one is coming from Martin. Martin says, client has not filed for 3 years, 15, 17, and 18. However, he has been assessed for prior years, totaling $41,000, and there's a bunch of years there that he lists. I will file the 2015, 17, and 18 as soon as possible. There have been attempts to garnish money from the bank. However, he does not deposit self-employment checks, but cashes them to prevent garnishment. What should I do next, is his question.
Okay, so after preparing and filing the delinquent returns, I would order account transcripts periodically until those returns post and the liabilities are assessed. Then he'll start getting notices for the unpaid tax liabilities, and I would call ACS, and depending on the taxpayer's financial situation, which we spoke about before, anywhere from putting the taxpayer into currently non-collectible status to submitting an offer or a partial pay or full pay installment agreement based on the taxpayer's situation. But the important thing is prepare and file the returns and then keep an eye out on when those returns post, because until they post and the liability actually becomes due, it's too early to contact the IRS because they're not going to know about it. And the problem is if you set up an installment agreement, for instance, for the prior years that have already been assessed, and 15, 16, and 17 or whatever years your delinquent returns get posted, posting of those delinquent returns will breach the installment agreement and you'll be back at ground zero and you'll have to go into a new installment agreement. So you really don't want to go through the whole trouble of negotiating an installment agreement until all the liabilities have been assessed.
All right. And he's also asking, now this is a different client who is bankrupt, Chapter 13, and does owe for 2016 $56,000 for not reporting 401k transactions. 2018 looks like he's going to owe again. So a 90-day letter for 2016 will be up on March 19th. I have submitted forms 433F for consideration of prior debt owed, but they have very little extra money to pay full balance in full. I'm hoping for a 2-year wait when Chapter 13 will expire. IRS indicated that they do not need any more information than what they have submitted. What should I do next?
Okay. Unless you're a bankruptcy attorney, this is really something for the bankruptcy attorney to handle. And the reason I say that is because in a Chapter 13, post-petition tax liabilities are what's called administrative claims. And so the IRS could file an administrative claim in the Chapter 13 for the post-petition tax liabilities. And then the taxpayer is going to have to come up with a way of paying for it in the bankruptcy, in the Chapter 13. I don't know if it's 100% plan or not, but it could be determined that the administrative claims render the plan infeasible, in which case the trustee will move to dismiss the case for infeasibility. So there's a lot of issues here and really not something for CPA or EA to deal with unless the IRS agrees not to file an administrative claim and to be paid outside of bankruptcy. But the problem with that is if the debtor's making payments outside the plan, then the trustee's question is, where's the money coming from? Because supposedly the plan ate up all the taxpayer's disposable income. And so he shouldn't have any disposable income to pay any creditors outside the plan. And so that could be a problem. So the only thing that you could possibly do would be if you could get the IRS to agree to, number one, not file an administrative claim, and number two, to wait until after the bankruptcy in order to start getting paid. And frankly, good luck with that. I don't see that happening. So I think the taxpayer really should be dealing. This is really an issue for the bankruptcy attorney, because once the IRS files that administrative claim, then all bets are off, because it may render the plan infeasible and he may be looking at the case being dismissed.
All right, Martin, hopefully you heed that advice. Next question from online is from Eric. Eric, I heard you talk about the penalty abatements earlier, Norman. He's saying, If the taxpayer has been denied the first-time penalty abatement, what are acceptable reasonable cause arguments that can be made to have the penalties abated?
Yeah, so reasonable cause is basically that the taxpayer relied on advice from a tax professional and that it was reasonable for the taxpayer to rely on that advice to his detriment, and that once he realized that the professional's advice was incorrect, that he did something to correct it. So it's usually something to do with the tax return preparer or the CPA or the EA, some advice that he gave the taxpayer that turned out to be incorrect. It can't be something like the tax professional gave him the wrong due date of the return, because that's something that the IRS has determined is something that the taxpayer can determine themselves. They don't need to go to a tax professional to learn when their 1040 is due. So it has to be more complicated than that. And there's no downside to the tax professional to admit that they gave them bad advice. And so I would need to see the scenario to determine whether or not it would work, but they would probably need a letter or something from the tax professional corroborating what the taxpayer is saying. Also, for instance, unfortunately, if the tax professional electronically filed a return and erroneously told the taxpayer that their return was electronically filed, and then that e-filing was rejected, but didn't tell the taxpayer, and the taxpayer found out when they got a notice that there was a delinquent return, that's not reasonable cause. So basically it's some advice from the tax preparer that turned out to be incorrect.
Okay, it looks like we have time for one more here from online. This is from Janesh. How would you qualify for a partial pay? You were speaking about the different options resolving the client's matter, so he wants to know, how do you qualify for partial pay?
Right. So if you're dealing with ACS, for instance, you've completed a 433F. So 433F lists your assets, lists your income, and lists your expenses. So if you can verify your income, let's say you're a W-2 employee, and all your expenses are within the standards, so all your expenses are deemed to be necessary and reasonable. So your expenses first have to be necessary, and then they have to be reasonable. So for instance, it's necessary that you have a car so that you can get to work, but it's not reasonable that you're, like our clients, that you're leasing a Rolls Royce or a Bentley, you know. So for instance, the IRS allows about $500 a month for a car payment. That's for purchase or lease. So if you have a car payment and it's $500 or less, then the IRS is going to allow that. And so if you add up all your allowable expenses that the IRS have deemed to be necessary and reasonable, and at the end of all that, your disposable income is not enough to pay the amount of tax that you owe within the life of the collection statute, then you have a partial pay installment agreement, and you're going to make those payments every month until the statute expires and the tax becomes uncollectible. and then the balance is forgiven and you stop making payments.
And that's how you qualify, Danish. Hopefully that answers your question. All right, guys, thank you very much for joining us this month on our practitioners forum call. This concludes this month's event. Join us next month on April 2nd for next month's practitioners forum call. It's going to be right in the middle of tax season, so hopefully you can join us at that time. Any questions that we did not get to, I will push forward to April 2nd. If you need an immediate answer, please email me directly. If you are a VIP member, consider using your consultation time to schedule with one of our professionals to get your questions answered sooner. Again, I have pushed the link. Check out the chat box if those of you that are interested in joining and taking the free trial to become a VIP member. Thanks again, everyone. I will be on for another 5 or 10 minutes. If you have any further questions, I will be available. Hope you enjoy the rest of the month, and we'll talk again April 2nd.